Welcome to day 5 of the 12 Days of Podcasts. This series of 12 perfect episodes is brought to you by the good people at Def Jam. It's December and nothing is colder than Jeezy's new album, Pressure. We once were asked by MTV to do a funny interview with Jeezy, and we asked him how to build a snowman. He said, from the ground up. And we thought, huh, that's not a very funny answer, until much later, when we were both like, oh, that's actually a very smart answer, maybe Jeezy does have a very good sense of humor. Anyway, I really like Jeezy's album, and I hope you do too. Go to JeezyShop.com to listen to Pressure, buy some merch, and maybe, for the first time, wonder, maybe Jeezy is much funnier than you would expect.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. Day 5 of the 12 Days of Podcast, our favorite stupid annual treat that we give to our fans. How are we doing?
Pretty good, I think.
Are we going
to
make it?
We are going to make it because the math is on our side.
Okay, hallelujah.
Hallelujah, holla back. Shouts to John Brown out in Brooklyn.
So, guys, the biggest news this week is that we are returning to New York. Yes, we live in New York, but we are returning to the stage in New York City. You asked for it. We deliver on January 10th, 2018. Jeff, we're going to be at SOB's doing a live podcast.
I'm putting it in the calendar right now.
We're talking comedy, music, storytelling. It's an event you do not want to miss. If you went to our Highline show, you know what it is. If you went to our SOB's show, you know what it is. If you're out in LA and you went to our show out there, you know what that is. And if you're out in London and you saw our show with DJ Semtex,
then fly over.
That's it. Just fly over and tell us that you know what it is. On January 10th, 2018, we're back at SOB's on stage. Get your tickets right now at itsthereal.com.
Now, we're not going to say that we're going to reunite Rockefeller Records again.
Why would we say that?
We're not saying anything.
We're definitely not going to say that we are celebrating Rockefeller Records again.
That's not what we're doing on January 10th. But
if you want to show up with that in mind,
yeah,
we're not going to tell you that you shouldn't dream those dreams.
Everybody should have an active imagination as to what this show is going to be.
So listen, January 10th, 2018, in mere weeks.
Yeah.
At SOB's here in New York City, we will be on stage, and maybe...
maybe Jay-Z will be there.
We can neither confirm nor deny.
No, we are keeping our options open. Jay-Z might be there.
Jay-Z listens to this podcast. Jay, if you want to come through, we will not stop you.
I mean, like, listen, Jay's got a lot of things going on. One of those things might be coming to SOB's on January 10th.
Do you know what he's doing on January 10th?
I'm not saying on the podcast, but okay. I'm also not saying.
Listen, guys, itsthereal.com, itsthereal.com is where you can go get your tickets. Get one for Jay. Buy one for yourself and one for Jay-Z.
Consider it a Christmas present.
And we'll see you in January on stage at SOB's. Jeff.
Yes.
Who's on the podcast today?
Today we have Fafu.
Fafu, our friend who works over at Translation, which is Steve Stout's company,
but
he has such a deep history in music, and we're talking music production, we're talking DJing, we're talking directing music videos, we're talking bidding wars.
He worked with Puffy, he worked with Prince, he worked with the Blue Man Group.
That is a crazy story.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask him but I didn't is if he ever started some shit with the Stomp guys.
Oh, yeah. That is really funny.
Yeah, the conversation just moved too quickly for me to ask that question, but should I was going to ask.
Should we have him back up here?
We should have him back up here because you would be surprised how much stuff we cover and yet how much stuff there is left to cover.
It's a great episode. Jeff, we like these particular episodes, like the David Cho one, like the Jenna Luckman one, like the Waz and Nod ones. Friends of ours in real life that we can put onto this platform and maybe our audience isn't so aware of them. It's not like, for example, what's his name?
Jay-Z.
Jay-Z, the guy who's going to be at our SOB show.
SOB show. We don't want to tip our hand.
That's right.
Yeah.
But these episodes are great because everybody has a great story to tell. Fafu has a tremendous story to tell, and we're happy that you guys have the time to listen to this great episode. So, Jeff?
Yes.
When do you want to get into it?
Right after I say that OT Genesis will be on the podcast tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, when, Jeff?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Money Moves, a.k.a. Catch Me If You Can.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. 10 Toes Down, a.k.a. Bad Lawnmower Accident.
What up? It's Fafu, a.k.a. Mr. Beats Band.
Yeah, this is a waste of time, this is the real. Fafu, welcome back to the Upper West Side for your official full episode, because after Prince passed away, as people may recall, we had you up here to talk about Paisley Park and your experiences in Minnesota and we got a good like half hour from you, and we've known you longer than that, clearly, and we know a lot more of your story, but there's so much more to dive into, including the fact that you sent us an email with some things that you just like thought of one day.
Yeah, some highlights.
And they are
that was my publicist.
Incredible. They're absolutely incredible.
It includes the line, moved back east to work with Blue Man Group.
Yeah.
Which by the way, you said fell apart.
Because you had to go work with Randy Jackson from American Idol.
No. Well, the Blue Man Group thing fell apart because a pipe burst in there. In their storage space, which is where they had their studio set
Wait,
up.
Wait, one of their pipes?
No, not
they play the pipes.
Right. Yeah. No, not one of those. Like a water pipe.
Yeah.
And it flooded the studio that we'd been building, and then all of a sudden that was just kind of derailed.
Well,
that's a good place to start.
Well, no, I do want to start at the very beginning. Where are you originally from?
I'm from York, Pennsylvania.
And what is York, Pennsylvania like? Rust Belt? Like,
it's an industrial town that kind of a lot of the industry moved away.
How much like Flashdance was it?
I don't know if I've ever seen Flashdance.
Have you seen Deer Hunter?
Yes.
How much like Deer Hunter?
Not the Vietnam part.
Okay.
But yeah, kind of. I think so. But yeah, Harley Davidson is...
based out there?
No, I think they're originally from Milwaukee or something, right. But they have a factory there where they put together bikes.
So
and
that
York
was the
Peppermint
big...
Patties were
oh,
there.
Sure. Yeah.
York Barbell, York Air Conditioning.
And what did your folks do?
My dad worked in hydroelectric turbines.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you then like had an idea of what that all entailed?
No. He never told me anything about it, to be honest.
Was that the Peppermint Patty plant?
Yes.
Or was that okay, yeah.
They had a waterfall and they wanted to try to, you know, make
sure.
some money off the
yeah.
water.
What are your thoughts on chocolate and mint together?
Great. The only time I really like dark chocolate is in that peppermint patty.
Really?
Oh, here it comes.
Oh, I'm a huge dark chocolate fan. I don't even.
Yeah, talk about it, guys.
I don't even fuck with milk chocolate.
I fuck with dark chocolate. I'll eat milk chocolate. I'll eat white chocolate.
Just any chocolate?
Any chocolate you put in front of me, I'll eat it.
I like dark chocolate, but I definitely prefer the milk.
Company town, clearly. Like different.
Yeah.
Do a lot of people just stay there and not leave?
Yes. Well, actually. Let me say this. All of my close friends in high school, everybody left. But a lot of people stayed.
Did everyone go to college? Or did everyone just like get out of town?
I think the ones that left, for the most part, probably went to college.
So by the end of high school, where's your head at? Are you like with your friends? Or you're like, I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Getting the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
Like I guess probably from probably ninth grade on, I was just like, definitely I gotta leave.
Do you have any older siblings?
Yes, one older. He's still there.
Okay. He didn't give you the blueprint as far as getting out.
No.
So how did
Nobody gave me the blueprint.
How'd you get in your head that like you actually could leave?
Well, I was into music and there was just no music there.
None.
Well, actually, I shouldn't say that because the band Live is from my hometown.
Oh, yeah.
And they were kind of the same age as us.
They're back, by the way.
Yeah, I think the singer got back with the group. They were still... They actually have a crazy studio in the middle of like the hood in York, PA. And it's like a crazy $1 million... It's weird.
Yeah.
But
so the Live economy is like huge in York, Pennsylvania?
I think for them.
Yeah. Yes. You know, you're interested in music. What were your musical aspirations as a kid?
Well, I was really into hip hop. And hip hop kind of turned me on to everything else. Like, honestly, I'd never heard Led Zeppelin before the Beastie Boys sampled them.
Wow.
So in high school, hip hop turned me on to James Brown and Sly Stone and P-Funk and all that stuff. And I guess in the sort of college years, when I would have been in college, that's kind of, I was listening more to like funk
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And then I came back to hip hop.
But you had no sort of musical background yourself?
Like my parents or anything?
No, like were you playing like instruments in
yeah.
school? Oh, you were?
Yeah, I mean, I played drums when I was a teenager and then I started playing guitar in high school.
Did you do marching band?
No, I didn't do any of those school. Actually, I did play guitar in like, I think it was called jazz band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But jazz wasn't for you.
I like jazz. Not the kind of jazz we were playing in high school. We weren't playing Miles Davis and John Coltrane.
Were you doing heroin?
Allegedly. No. Off the record. No. No, not at all. Actually, I was totally straight edge until I was 23.
At the end of high school, you cross the stage, you get your diploma. And then what?
So I did go to music school for like a semester in Boston. And that I wanted to get into production, but it was kind of like a thing where you had to be there for a few years before they, you, and then you had to get into that department. So I just skipped out on that. And then I ended up moving to Minneapolis probably pretty soon after that.
Okay. So skipped out on that, meaning you dropped out.
Yeah.
Of school. Did you tell your parents?
Yeah.
And what'd they say?
They weren't crazy about it. But I mean, going to school for music, what, I mean, I don't know what they thought I was going to do with that anyway.
Right. So you decided that Minnesota was the sort of...
Yeah, my dad got remarried in Minnesota, and I went out there for the wedding, spent some time out there. I was also really into the whole Prince scene. Mm-hmm. Well, like, I was really into Prince's music, and I had this idea that the Minneapolis music scene was this big like funk mecca, which I guess it had been at one point, but when I got there that existed, but there was also it's a very small scene, so mm-hmm. everybody in all the different genres, if you're, you know, rise to the top, all those people know each other cross genre. And yeah, I mean, it's a really dope music scene. It just wasn't like necessarily like a funk scene, and there really was no hip-hop scene then at the time either.
And where did you see yourself fitting in?
That's a really good question. I have no idea what I thought I was doing. Looking back, I don't know.
You had a place to stay.
Yes.
Your dad was on board with like you crashing there.
No, I got an apartment, actually.
Okay, you did.
Yeah.
And where were you working?
I did a bunch of jobs. Like, I worked, I delivered pizzas for Pizza Hut for a while. I sold hot dogs on the street in like a vendor thing.
Really?
But yeah, like, in like a funky way.
Yes, yeah. Actually, yes, because I met this guy, Andre, randomly, and he was like, yeah, I didn't even tell him that I played instruments or anything. He's like, yo, you want to jam with me? And I was like, all right. So he played keyboards and sang, and I started playing guitar with him, and he sold hot dogs at this place. So he was like, come work over here or whatever. So
that's amazing. So wait, so it was just in the air, the sort of like,
I guess I just looked like I played music.
Or did drugs.
And I didn't do drugs yet.
So, yeah. So you're out in Minneapolis. What's Minneapolis like?
Cold.
Yeah.
When I got there, the year I got there, on Halloween, they had like 2 feet of snow. It was like it was early in the year, and it was like a record thing or whatever. But yeah, it was crazy.
It's hard to like dress up as something slutty when there's 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Luckily, I wasn't dressing slutty.
Was there something going on every night? Like downtown?
Yeah, but the bars close at 1. Like the liquor license or whatever, they stop at 1. So yeah, there were a couple clubs. There's First Avenue, mm-hmm. a famous mm-hmm. place. Prince had this club called Glam Slam. There were a bunch of clubs. And then what happened was, yeah, when I first got there, I didn't know anybody. I met some weird people, definitely. But one guy told me about this bar on the edge of town called Bunkers, and it's like a biker bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went there, and it was every Monday and Tuesday night, there was this band called Dr. Mambo's Combo. And they
Great name.
Yes. Awesome.
Yeah.
No, but they were incredible. Like the girl who sang Funky Town, mm-hmm. Cynthia Johnson, shout
from
out
Lip
to
Sync Incorporated.
Lip Sync, yes.
Yeah.
She was one of the singers. They had three Whoa. Singers, and she was one of them. And the other one was this girl, Margaret Cox, who was in a group called Tamara in the Scene, which was produced by Jesse Johnson at the time. And then there was another woman, Debbie Duncan, who was like a jazz blues singer or whatever. But the drummer in that band was Prince's drummer, and there were everybody in the band was better than any musician I've seen in New York ever.
At this bar at the edge of town.
Bar at the edge of town. And everybody would come in, like people would come through town and come down and sit in with them all the time. Like Taj Mahal, like all these just random people. And I got a great story. One night, Guns N' Roses was really, really big at the time. And I guess they were on tour, they were in town, and Axel had a sore throat, like got sick or something, and they had to cancel a couple of shows, so they stuck around in town. And Slash came down.
Whoa.
And he sat in with them, which was hilarious because he had the big top hat and he had the whole Slash, like tons of people there. I mean, obviously, you know, he's famous, and he plays on a blues song with them, and Debbie Duncan, this woman, sang the song, and she had no idea who he was. So they're doing this blues song, and he's like drunk, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And he's playing
playing over her, like, the whole time. It's just like every line, there's like a blues lick in between, whatever. And she's getting annoyed or whatever. And he took this huge solo or whatever. And at the end of the song, she's like, you know, because everybody kind of crowded the stage because fucking Slash is on stage.
Yeah.
And at the end of the song, she's like, yeah, special thanks to on guitar. What's your name? Splash, ladies and gentlemen. It was amazing.
So who are you? You're just hanging.
I'm just some kid. And I, oh yeah, that's right. I wasn't even 21. I had a fake ID. And I didn't drink, but yeah. I had a fake ID. An older friend of mine in my hometown went in and said he lost his ID, and they'd send you a form and you just go take the picture, and I went and took the picture for him. And I think I paid him $100 and he still had his ID that he hadn't lost.
Wait, so. What was your name?
Should I say?
No, I don't know. But it was
my name. My name was Byron, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I still have that somewhere. Shout out to Byron.
Was he, like, significantly older? Was he, like, a 45-year-old?
And
it was
no.
Like,
it, like, that would have been amazing. Yeah.
It was passable?
Older. Yeah. Yeah, he was only, like, 2 years older than
gotcha.
Me.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you're not even 21. You don't have a college degree. You're selling hot dogs in Minneapolis.
Yeah. So you know what I did? I went to a recording school.
Up there?
Yeah. Like a tech school or whatever for music.
Was that something where, like, it was worth your while?
Did you meet a lot of girls?
Very few. Very few girls in that school. Yeah. No, yeah, I think it was worth my while because, well, it taught me some of the basics of like, studio recording and all that. But while I was there, I ended up linking up with this engineer around town named Tommy Tucker Jr., and he kind of took me under his wing as like an apprentice or whatever, and really, like, he had lost his license, so I was really driving him around.
Were you driving or was Byron driving?
I was driving, but yeah, and I guess Minneapolis was so cool because, like I said, it's a small town in terms of the music scene. So I got to I networked and got to know people, and I think I was better at that back then than I am now. So. I ended up, by the end of the school, it was a 1-year program. By the end, by the fourth quarter, I wasn't even showing up to class because I would be at Paisley Park with Foley from Miles' band, or, you know, in the studio with Tommy and some other, you know, Ipso Facto or whatever. It's like different bands and stuff.
What do you think it was about you rather than like anyone else who was around town who wanted that maybe as badly as you did?
Well, I think I did really, you know, I feel like I definitely had drive. I had nothing else going on in my life but wanting to be in music.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, when people met me, I think they thought I was cool and could tolerate me being around them. You know? Yeah.
So you got to work immediately?
Yeah, I mean, mostly at first it was kind of like for free, like interning for people or whatever. And then I got a job at, there was a studio right there called Metro that, the school I went to used as a classroom for some of the classes. So I got a job there. A year later, maybe, I ended up at Paisley Park.
What kind of music do you think at that time was your specialty?
Yeah, I could. I mean, I worked with all different, because there was, back then, there were still metal bands.
Yeah.
Yeah. All types of artists. There was country artists that would come through there. And so I could engineer for them or whatever. But they'd always stick me with the hip hop acts because I had a sampler and I knew how to like run that kind of stuff or whatever.
So an SP or like a...
I had an Emax 2.
What is that?
It's made by Emu, who made... Yeah, they made a bunch of stuff. They made the emulator and they were kind of like an early sample thing.
And you're making your own beats?
I was making my own beats. I was making tracks. That's the thing I did back then. I would just stay up every night until like the sun came up and like be programming and trying to learn how to do all that stuff. Yeah.
What's the longest session that you have?
I don't know. Long though.
Like long enough where you're just like...
I never had any of those like 3-day sessions though. You know, that more, well, when I got to New York and started working with Bad Boy,
I had
long sessions, but even that, not really. I don't know. I mean, the thing is with Bad Boy, it would be like one session would take like it would be like a month. You know what I mean? So like that would be long, but it wouldn't be like the whole time in the studio.
Right. So, I mean, we did talk about Prince on the last podcast that you were up here for. I don't know how much we should go back into that right now.
But when was the first time you met Prince?
The first time I met Prince... That's a really good question. Yeah, I said this in the last one. You don't really meet him. You're just around him long enough that he's comfortable talking to you, you know. Yeah, the first time that I was face to face with him, was before I actually started working there, and the drummer, like his drummer is my man, Michael Bland. He's, you know, I love that guy. He like definitely looked out for me and tried to put me on even before maybe I was even ready. And he, at one point, like Prince always had guitar tech problems because, I don't know, he just didn't like his guitar techs most of the time or whatever. And at one point, Michael tried to get me to come out to help the guitar tech because they just wanted somebody to help out to like string up guitars and stuff.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew, you know, I mean, I played guitar, so, but I was definitely not a tech. And one day I came out there to meet that guy, and Prince was there on the sound stage, and he was like, "Is he the new tech?" And I was like, "Oh my God, do not say I'm the new guitar tech." But no, yeah, I mean, I didn't really meet him. I met him later once I started programming for him, and then he liked what I was doing. So he kind of like, you know, talked to me directly and asked me to do things to change things or whatever.
Did your father understand, like, the power of Prince? Like,
at that point, well, he did.
Because his father didn't, as seen in the movie Purple Rain.
True. No, so, yeah, he, you know, it's funny, he did... Once he started to tell people my son works with Prince,
yeah,
then he was like, "Oh, you should see the women I was talking to at the airport. They were pretty excited about this."
I mean, Prince ran that town, right? It was his city.
Yeah, I mean, he did for sure. Although Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis were doing their thing at that time with Janet Jackson and all that stuff that they did in the same town. They had their own studio, and then there was like the whole indie rock scene from Minneapolis, which was really big too, with the Replacements and Husker Du and all that.
And the funky hot dog band that you guys were in.
Yeah, yeah. That, we did some gigs. It was, I don't even know what it was called. It was like Andre, I guess.
Was there enough of an ecosystem out there for like everybody to get regular work?
Yeah, live music is really popular there. So all of my friends from Minneapolis are musicians, and they all are still doing it in one capacity or another. And some of them tour with people, and then when they go back, when they're off... When they're in town, they're doing local gigs all the time, and they're teaching people. Some people work at like jingle houses and stuff like that.
And did you like Minnesota when it warmed up, like over the summer?
I liked it a lot, man. I mean, I love that city. The people there are great. All the people I worked with in you know, at Metro Studios and at Paisley Park, and then yeah, there was this band that I worked with called Greasy Meal. And those guys are all still like really tight friends of mine.
So your relationship with Prince and Paisley Park sort of expanded, and you were there regularly.
I was there, yeah. Once I started, at first it was just a freelance thing for a little while. Once I became full time, I was there every day. Prince would rehearse his band every single day for a year, and then we'd go on tour for like 2 weeks. So that band was super tight. Even when he wasn't there, they had to be there at noon. Like for, I'd say from like noon till 5, they were running through songs.
Recording the
no.
set?
No. Okay. But I would, they would videotape the rehearsals. And eventually, once he got familiar with me, he'd have me videotape the rehearsals.
What's the smallest thing that Prince was like really particular about?
Well, at first, I was dealing with drum programming for his live show. So he was very particular about things being tight and not being sloppy.
Would he suggest certain sounds to you?
Not really, but he would say like, yeah, make this sound like a remix or whatever. And then I would add my own flavor in my own time. And then the next day they'd go through it in rehearsal. And sometimes he'd be like, nah, take that out or whatever. One time they sent my man Magoo, shout out to Magoo. He sent Goo down to the tech room to get me to change something from the song 7. I had put like a go-go loop in it, like a cowbell loop or something. And he was like, yo, boss wants you to take the go-go loop out of 7. So I walked all the way up across the atrium back to the soundstage. By the time I opened the big door, he gets on the mic. He's like, nah, it's cool. We're keeping it. So, yeah, it was awesome, though. Like, I would program these. I would take the beats that he had for the songs that they were performing. I would sample what he'd do in the studio, like the drum programming, loop it, add, like, fortify it with more kicks and snares, and then also always add something else, like some element, because he wanted everything to sound like a remix. So a lot of times those sounds that I would add, he would take them into the studio and lay them down on new material that, that he was working on. So there's an album called Exodus by the NPG, which was his band, that has my sounds all over it.
That's
and
awesome.
There's a couple other things, yeah.
Are there any better live performers than Prince?
No.
Are there any worse performers than Prince?
A few. A lot.
Yeah. Name every single one.
Yeah.
So your time with Prince ends and you go back to New York?
No, I stayed in Minneapolis for a little while afterwards. I worked with that band Greasy Meal. And then I came out to New York with the bass player from Greasy Meal, Jim Anton, brought me out here to work with one of the guys from the Blue Man Group. And we came out and hung out for a few days in this guy's house in Brooklyn and recorded a bunch of tracks and ideas and stuff. And this guy liked me too, so... I think Jim was like, you should go out and work with, you should just move to New York. At one point, I was like, I didn't want to be in Minneapolis anymore. He's like, you should go to New York and work with Blue Man Group or something. I don't know how it happened, but I got in contact with them. They were building a studio, and they're like, yeah, come out. And I came to New York. And
so you've heard the Blue Men speak?
Yep. Yeah.
But wait, with the paint on?
Nope.
Okay. Because like, there's like strict rules, right, where they like they don't speak with the paint on.
Dude, is that true? I don't know.
I think so. I think it's just like it, when they're in character, they're in character. It's like, you know.
Like Disney World.
Yeah, or yeah. Jim Carrey being Andy Kaufman.
Yeah. I never talked to them with their. I mean, I really only met with the actual Blue Men once or twice. And then, like, the guy that hired me, Ian Pei, shout out to him.
The architect?
Yeah.
No.
Ian Pei?
No, Ian.
Ian. Like yeah. Ian's earring.
Yeah. Actually, it's Ian.
Oh.
Or no, Ian. Ian. Ian Pei, yeah.
So he wasn't the guy that did the Vietnam Memorial.
No.
Deer Hunter.
Yeah. No, he was not. Ian, you know, he was just, he was the drummer. He was the original drummer, but like those guys that perform as the Blue Men now aren't the original Blue Men.
Right. No. It's like Menudo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, so I worked with them, but I came out to work with them, and then, like I said, their thing flooded. Their studio flooded, and I was kind of, so my, you know, I was actually staying in Pennsylvania at my mom's house and trying to figure out how to get to New York, and you know, New York is so expensive. So I was going to come up here and live once we had the studio built, but I was just visiting. They had a crash pad where traveling Blue Men and musicians and people like me would stay. So I was staying there the day that the pipe burst, and it was across the street. And, you know, I helped them clean it up a little bit, but then it was kind of like, all right, we're going to put this on hold. We're opening a new show in Chicago. We're going to wait until that's done. So I went back to Pennsylvania and DJed a little bit. And then randomly, Randy Jackson... Michael Bland and my man John Field, shout out to him, both told me independently of one another that Randy Jackson was asking about me.
Oh, and what did you know about Randy Jackson to this point?
Not much. So I met Randy Jackson on the street in Minneapolis one day.
Was he walking his dog?
He was with my friend. Well, he was with Michael Bland.
Mm-hmm.
They were walking. And I was with a girl. We ran into each other. They had just come out of a Soul Asylum secret show at the 7th Street Center.
So yeah. 1994.
Definitely yeah. A date and time.
Like, yeah, totally. And Michael Bland is actually in Soul Asylum now.
Really?
Yeah. They had just seen a surprise show at the 7th Street Entry, which is like the small club out in First Avenue. And then I met him on the street, and Michael was like, yeah, this is Fafu, or this is Faf. He's my programmer or whatever. And Randy was asking me all these questions and stuff. And then, like, yeah, I don't know. Was that like a year later or something? And maybe Randy knew that I worked with Greasy Meal and I worked with Michael Bland or something, because John Fields was in Greasy Meal.
And you have an easy name to remember, so.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. John Fields actually gave me the name Fafu.
Wait, why?
I don't know, because everybody called me Faf.
Mm-hmm.
And,
why did they call you Faf?
Because my last name is Faflin.
Right.
And then, I wasn't crazy about Faf back then, but I walked in the studio one day and he did like a karate chop move and he's like, Fafu! And I was like, oh, that's my DJ name. Because I was DJing at the time, too. Yeah, that's how I got the name Fafu. And then John Fields went on to produce all the Jonas Brothers albums.
Wow.
Yeah.
What had Randy Jackson been doing up to that point?
He was Mariah Carey's bass player, musical director, and he was Tommy Mottola's head of A&R, like right-hand man.
Oh, my God. That's a lot of, like, crossed wires.
Yeah, totally. So, I was thinking about moving to L.A. My girl wanted to move to L.A., so... I really didn't like LA, but I went out there because of, you know, Randy, and I met with him, And yeah, he was like, yeah, dog, we're gonna do all this. Like, he told me, he's like, we're gonna do, I want to write songs with you, I want to start a band with you, we could do remixes together, and I could use you as a programmer and stuff. And then I was like, oh great,
yeah,
if
all right,
any one of those four things happens, I'm good. So I went to LA and he never returned my calls.
What?
Yeah, I called him once a week for the first like 2 or 3 months that I was there. Shout out to Randy.
that's so fucked up.
Yeah, it's fucked up. And then he calls me up 6 months later, and it's like, Randy Jackson's on the phone for you. I'm like, yeah. And this is before Pro Tools was really like everybody had it and everybody used it and stuff. And I get on the phone and he's like, yeah, what's up, Fat? Yo, you got Pro Tools? I'm like, no. He's like, all right, cool. I'm gonna call you. And that was it. Yeah.
You should have ambushed him on set of American Idol.
This was way before.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying like years later, yeah. You show up like with a cloud of smoke coming around you, yeah. And you're like, hey.
I did have two more interactions with Randy Jackson since then.
Fuck really? Him. Yeah. What? What? How were that? Were they good?
Yeah. Well, at one point, I almost did a stint of recording with Mariah, and Randy had to call me and tell me how she worked on vocals and stuff, and I was going to go to Anguilla, I think, and record vocals with her, like take a whole Pro Tools rig down there. She was writing songs, and it got canceled at the last minute. I don't think she wrote anything.
Typical Randy.
Yeah,
totally. And then once when I was with my group Less Than Nation and we were shopping it, I don't know how that all came together, but I went and met with Randy at a at a place here in Manhattan with our manager Morgan, and Randy was hitting on the waitress, and he was like, are you a singer? You should be in his group. I'm like, that's how Fergie got into Black.
Yeah. Wait, so you go out to LA, this guy is not picking up your phone calls for 3 months?
Yeah.
So what'd you like resign yourself to do?
I was doing I don't know. I mean, I did, like, I got these random gigs through, like, my musician friends and stuff, but they wouldn't be good. Like, I would work on a session, and then the guy would give me, like, $50 or something. I'm like, what am I doing this for?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I was doing some programming stuff. I was not doing a lot. And then, I got the call one day to go on tour with Puff.
Okay. How in the world does that happen?
So this was my man Scotty Baldwin from Paisley Park. He recommended me to the production manager for the No Way Out tour in 98.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's crazy too. It was a really rough time for me because my best friend had just died.
Oh my God. Mm.
And I was still in mourning. Like, I was really going through it. And, they called me to do it and they were like, you know, this is probably like 2 months after or something. And, and the guy calls me and he's like, have you heard of Puff Daddy? And like, yes. And he's like, you want to go on tour? I was like, okay. And he's like, you got to go today. Whoa. You got to get on a plane today to go to Albany, New York. They're doing dress rehearsals or set rehearsals or whatever.
Oh, right.
Tech rehearsals.
Yeah.
In Albany, New York. And we need you there right now or whatever. So I had to, he's like, go do your laundry, pack your bags. You're going away for 7 weeks.
To program?
No, to do backline, which is like setting up equipment and stuff.
Yeah.
Which for that tour, that was only two people. That was Stevie J, who had a percussion rig, a keyboard, and a bass guitar. I think that's what his whole setup was. And then Clark Kent had turntables.
Wow.
And that's what I was supposed to do. And I got there, and Stevie J had, you know what, you guys know what ADATs are?
Yeah.
No.
ADATs are like an early digital recording format that was on VHS tapes. It was like super VHS tapes, and they'd hold 8 tracks of digital audio. So this is before Pro Tools was really used heavily, and it was kind of like an amateur, you know, thing or whatever, but a format. But that's what they were using to run the show. So Stevie J was supposed to press play on the music and then start playing along with it, and he was like, I ain't doing that. So he made me do it, and then I went to the production manager and I was like, I need more money.
Yeah.
I'm running the show. I'm literally playing all the music for the show other than the percussion. So I ended up doing that. I was sitting on the side of the stage, like, you know, pressing play, and I'd have cue points because there'd be certain sections where it would be three or four songs back to back, and then you'd stop and someone would talk, and I'd have a cue to the next section, and like 112 would come out, and Stevie J would have his acoustic guitar that he was pretending to play, and as soon as he started, I would have to press play, but the crazy thing is that the set would change all the time, and this is when I met my man Michael Patterson. And he was in their studio bus with Pro Tools editing the show, and then he'd be bouncing it down to ADATS. So sometimes there was the first set and the second set, and sometimes during the first set, he's bringing me the tape for the second set with numbers written down of what the cue points were, which weren't 100%. You know what I mean? It was never like 100% right. So, but it all worked out.
Who was on that tour?
Man, everybody was on that tour. So our set was just Puff Daddy and the Family. So the Lox, Mace, Kim was on in our set. Junior Mafia. I don't want to forget anybody. Carl Thomas. 112 was definitely on it. Carl Thomas, maybe he wasn't on that tour, but he was on a European tour that I did. And
Faith Evans?
No. But then opening for us, I'll go in reverse order. Busta Rhymes went on right before us, and that was he was like, "Put Your Hands Where Eyes Can See."
Oh my God.
That album, and before that, Jay-Z.
Oh my God.
And before that was The Firm with Nas and Foxy Brown. And before that was Usher Raymond.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And before that was Kid Capri, and he played the beat for Hard Knock Life.
Right. Yeah. So that's a lot of buses.
Oh my God, was it ever? Yeah.
Who did you ride with?
I rode with, on that tour, I rode with the Sound and Light crew, and those guys hated me because they all had to get to the venue like early to set up all their stuff, and I could just like smoke weed until noon and come out and set up my little things and then do the show. And then I would also be done way before them.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because, you know, I had been technically a roadie with Prince when I toured with him, and this was the first, like, roadie gig outside of that, and I instantly was like, this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life. All these guys, and, you know, no disrespect to them or their profession, but they all live, like, you know, on the road all year long. They had kids with multiple people in different cities, and the lifestyle was hard, you know, like, mm-hmm. there's a lot of chemical usage and bad food and, you know, sleeping on a bus and I don't know. It wasn't for me. And plus, like, you know, I really wanted to make music, not just like plug in stuff for other people to.
Did you get a chance to make any music with anyone on Bad Boy at that time?
Not on that tour, no. Mm-hmm. But I got to know Michael Patterson really well, who was instrumental in helping me, you know, with my career.
And again, you're showing your face around and people know you and they're comfortable with you around, and then the tour ends.
Yeah.
And
what was the goodbye party like?
Oh my God. So here's the goodbye party. So we had to do Vancouver. So I think we did like Seattle or something. Then we went up to Vancouver, and then we went back into the States to do some city. And then we were supposed to go up and do another city in Canada, but not on the West Coast, more in the middle.
Like a Calgary or a...
Maybe. It wasn't as far east as like Montreal or Toronto, but it was like
a Winnipeg or something.
Maybe, something like that. And when we got to the border, they were waiting for us. This is like middle of the night. And they pulled up, everyone's sleeping in the bus, and they come wake us up, and they're like, you have to fill out these forms. And the first question was like, have you ever been arrested for anything ever?
Oh my God.
And so basically anybody that said yes on that couldn't go through. Oh. So we ended the tour right then and flew home because that was it was going to be the last show, but they were like, all right, turn the buses around. Somebody told me Puff was out of his bus, like walking around, like, what the fuck? But I just stayed in the bus. But yeah, they turned the buses around and took us to some city and flew us home. And
And home was L.A.?
L.A. at that point,
so you went back?
I went back to L.A. And it was good because I actually had money.
That is good.
Yeah.
What can you do with money in L.A., right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have that much money. But yeah, I stayed in L.A. for a little while. But I still couldn't get anything going creatively or even just like work-wise. I don't remember how much longer I stayed in LA, but then I stayed in contact with Michael Patterson, and I was making beats and I was, and Michael Blam was coming out to LA a lot, and we were making beats together. And I was just kind of building up this catalog of music. And then at one point I was like, man, this isn't working out. So I reached out to Patterson, and his wife answered. This is before you just called someone's cell phone, I guess. and she's like, oh, he's on a plane to LA right now. And he was mixing some Faith Evans song right down the street from where I lived. And, I went to the studio, hung out with him. Then he came to my studio. I played him some of the stuff I was working on. And he's like, do you want to work on hip hop? And you should move to New York.
And you said, okay.
Yeah. So I went to New York. I came to New York, and I stayed on my friend's floor for a month. And by the end of that month, I was in the Bahamas with the whole Bad Boy family working on the Forever album.
Wow. Does everybody remember you?
From the tour? No, I don't think so. I don't know. I think that somebody probably told Puff that I was that guy that was running the ADATs or something. Mm-hmm. I didn't really interact with him that much on the tour. I did a little bit. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if anybody remembered me. I didn't really get to know the artists on the tour.
But take us through the Bahamas. Like, is this in, like, a villa, and you just set up, like, a Pro Tools rig and everyone?
No. It was actually, we were at Compass Point Studio, which is Chris Blackwell's studio.
And Chris Blackwell is?
He's the guy that signed Bob Marley and started Island Records.
So it's a big villa.
Yeah. I mean, the studio wasn't that big. It was a decent studio, but then there was a resort across the street, and then behind the studio there were these apartments and kind of hotel rooms, which we stayed in. And, we stayed there for 3
forever.
Weeks. Yeah. We stayed there for 3 weeks. We were working on the Mace album, the Double Up album, which is the second album.
Yep.
Lil' Kim, Notorious K.I.M., obviously the Puff album, and I want to say like C's was recording there.
So did you just stay in the studio?
Yeah. We weren't allowed to do anything but stay in the studio. Damn. We were allowed to have a half day off on Sunday.
According to Puff?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I
how did you spend the half day off?
Well, I know one day we all went on a snorkeling trip, and I ended up swimming with sharks.
That's cool.
With all the like engineers and stuff, and then we went back to the studio like, yeah, we swam with sharks. And Puff was like, why would you do that? And the funny thing about the swimming with sharks thing is we were on this, it was like one of those tour, like a snorkeling tour or whatever, and we joked saying, oh, can we swim with sharks? And they're like, oh, okay. So they took us over to this spot, and I was like the first one that was about to get off the boat, and then I had second thoughts, and there were other people that weren't with our party on the boat, and some old lady starts getting in. I'm like, nah, I'm not getting, not letting no old lady go first. I'm jumping in. So it was amazing. Like, went down, and they were pretty small sharks, but they would, even a small shark swimming directly towards you is pretty frightening.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you go back to the studio, though, and everything is sort of like, you know, better than that.
Yeah. No, we worked hard. That was like intense. It was like boot camp. You'd have a bunch of producers set up with these little rigs all over, and there were crates and crates of records. People were going through looking for samples. People were making beats. People were writing verses. Remixes were happening. Yeah, it was insane. And then producer wise, it was J-Dub was there. Mario Winans, Nasheem. Trying to think who else was down there. I don't know, but the Hitmen at the time.
But they were not swimming with sharks.
They were like jet skiing, having more fun than we were, for sure.
And so how many rooms were there?
I don't know, because a lot of the artists and producers stayed at like some fancy hotel in town, and we were on the edge of town. Puff stayed in the in like a suite where we were. It must not have been that big. Oh,
How many studio rooms?
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. Two studio rooms, and then there was Chris Blackwell had a house across the street, and we took that over and had that set up for like digging for samples and making beats.
Wow. Would people just rotate in and out? Like, you had a sort of set schedule that like Mace was going to record at this period of time, and Kim would come in at this period of time?
Yeah, totally. And then like Busy Bone came down, J-Lo came down.
Wow.
Was J-Lo recording, or she was just seeing Puff?
Yeah, just seeing Puff.
Yeah.
And she was, I mean, Benny Medina was managing Puff at the time and managing her. Yeah.
Who was the hardest working of any of the artists?
Artists?
Yeah.
That's a good question, because I don't really know. But I'll tell you, Mace came in with, like, everything written. Like, you know, a lot of MCs will write to the beat.
Yeah.
Mace would come in and be like, I would be in the studio with Mario a lot. and he'd come and be like, yo, is this for me? And then just spit a verse. And yeah, he had like he had his whole album written before he got there.
That's
or,
awesome.
Or at least a lot of it. Yeah.
And how much of your production ended up on any of those projects?
My production?
Yeah.
None.
Okay.
I was just kind of like helping the production team. Mm-hmm. But I ended up scratching on like DJ scratching on a lot of stuff.
That's dope.
Yeah.
So Puff just was just like, hey, I need some scratches.
And no. Like,
oh.
That was later. I gotta finish the I gotta finish the Bahamas part of it.
Yes.
Because there was an issue in the Bahamas with weed. There's no weed in the Bahamas.
Why not?
I mean, maybe there is now. But when I got there, I got there a couple of days early with the equipment or something. They sent me down to make sure everything showed up or something. And so I asked the people at that were running the house, where do I get weed? And they're like, oh, go to this fruit stand down the street, tell them, and they're going to call somebody and whatever.
Did you have to use like a code word?
I don't remember. But I remember the dude that sold me
like,
the
I'll
weed.
I'll take three bananas.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but some the dude that sold me the weed was like this. Like he looked like a gorilla, like military guy. Mm-hmm. Like, dressed in fatigues. Yeah. I think he might have had a machete.
Yeah.
And yeah, and he sold me this dirt weed that was terrible. and then Bad Boy showed up, and I think some people had brought like a couple bags with them or whatever, but that ran out pretty quick. And then one day Puff, I did not know Puff yet really, and Puff was walking down the hallway at the studio, and he's like, yo, who got some papers? And and I was like, I do. He's like, what do you roll with them? And I was like, joints. And he's like, all right, go get them. Like they were in my room. So I went and got them, and I came back, and he had this manila envelope, like a big one, you know, like a full size yeah. manila envelope full of weed that they got down there. And he was like, can you roll me a couple joints or whatever? And he had like a couple people with him. And he's like, what do you think of this weed? And I looked at it, and it wasn't good.
Yeah.
It was like garbage, like street weed. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And his man, Wolf, rest in peace, was there. And he was like, yo, Puff, it's got the orange hairs. Look at it. It looks good. It's got the orange hairs. And he's like, nah, I want to know what the white boy thinks. So I was like, I don't know. It looks like some bullshit to me. But I rolled him some joints or whatever. And then... the funny thing is, I had this little booth that I was set up in because, oh yeah, my role there was to put together a sample library of like kicks and snares and drum sounds and like, you know, different sounds that they could use or whatever. So that was my role, my first role with them in the studio. And
rolling was your second, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess. But so I had this little room set up with a Pro Tools rig, and I was. You know, chopping up all these samples and stuff. And I had incense going one day. Like, I had some Nag Champa that I brought with me. And Puff leans in, and he's like, what is that? I was like, that's incense. And he's like, all right, do you got more of that? Bring it up to my room. And he was, like, in the penthouse or whatever. So I go up to my room, get some sticks of incense, and go up to the penthouse and knock on the door. And this dude... D-Mac answers the door, and he's got a joint, like a big fat joint. And I was like, oh, what's this, local shit? And Puff is in the room with this girl sitting on the couch, and he's like, nah, that's imported from California in a pussy. Yeah, it was amazing. So yeah, so I smoked the weed, and it had, you know, had a little taste to it. Yeah, just playing.
Any orange hairs? Yeah.
No, but the funny thing is, D-Mac told me later, because I gave him like seven sticks of incense, and they were in a, you know, in a suite. He's like, light these. So they lit all of them, and I was kind of out of my element, and I should have been like, dude, just light one of them, but I didn't, and they lit all of them. And then D-Mac came up to me later, and he was like, yo, I had to put that shit out, man. No one could breathe. They were choking. Yeah.
So you had a good time down there?
Yeah. I worked hard.
Yeah.
Worked hard. But then came back to New York.
Were any samples off limits, by the way? Like just like money wise or?
I think that they wouldn't think about that until like they knew they wanted to use something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
And would you make any suggestions on any records or anything?
Yeah, I mean, mostly with Mario. I hung out with Mario most of the time,
mm-hmm.
and he would be like, yo, what, would you give me some sounds for this or whatever. And yeah.
Was he recording as an artist at the time?
No.
All right, I have a question about Mario Winans.
Mm-hmm.
He has a song called I Don't Want to Know,
mm-hmm.
where he says that if a girl's cheating on him, like, don't tell him. Would you tell him?
If I knew...
If you knew that Mario Winans was getting cheated on, would you tell him?
I don't think he wanted to know. Yeah, probably not.
I mean, he says that he doesn't want to know.
It's like the guy who had Do Not Resuscitate, like, tattooed on him. And, yes. like, you know, it was a very weird thing, so...
Yeah, yeah, that guy was not resuscitated.
Right.
I would tell Mario.
You know, it's funny. There were people that would tell on people for doing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those people weren't respected.
Yeah.
Even if you were telling the person you worked for that someone was stealing their drum sounds and shit.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Wait, so, tell us who.
Well, an engineer that I knew told me that a producer, one of the Hitmen producers, who wasn't really in the circle at the time, this is back after we got back to New York, would tell the engineer, hey, anything you work on, any sessions you work on, just copy all the drum sounds and put them on a DAT and give them to me.
Wow.
Which I'm sure, you know,
yeah.
people
yeah,
probably
a lot of
did
people
that
think,
all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
And he went back to the head of A&R. He went to Harv, I think, or Comrade or something at Bad Boy and told him, and, you know, they definitely laughed at him. It's like, this is hip-hop, man. That's what people do.
So after the Bahamas, did you feel like you were fully entrenched with the Bad Boy camp?
Yeah, were you Bad Boy for life?
Yeah, I mean, not yet. Once I got into it in New York, I definitely felt like I was.
So you came back and you're here in the studio? Were you at the Bad Boy Enterprises building, or where was the...
No, so first I went back to Pennsylvania. I think there was a break. I think it was like right before Christmas or something. I went back to Pennsylvania. I had them ship my whole rig that I was working with to my mom's house in Pennsylvania. And I worked on some stuff there. And then the next phase of it was we went to Atlanta for 2 weeks.
Again, shipping your stuff down there?
Yeah.
Oh, this is so, like, just crazy technology-wise.
Yeah, I know, because now you can do it all with a laptop. Yeah. This is, like, refrigerator-sized racks of stuff. So I went to Atlanta, and we worked out of a studio called Silent Sound, which is, like, the silent partner of L.A. Reid and Babyface. There was a third guy,
mm-hmm.
and he had this – he was, like, you know, less – public, I guess,
mm-hmm.
more private, and he had a studio that we worked out of, and right next door was DARP, which is Dallas Austin's studio.
Yeah.
And that's where Carl Thomas recorded, I think, most of that album with,
wow.
with the, you know,
that's dope.
Hit. Yeah.
Was it productive down there?
Yeah, super productive. It was weird because they wouldn't let us smoke weed in that studio. Even puff.
If Carl Thomas was getting cheated on, would you tell him?
No.
Neither would I.
Yeah. Shout out to Carl, though. I love Carl Thomas. Yeah. He's a good dude.
It's only Mario Winans I would tell.
Carl Thomas showed up at that Bad Boy reunion tour, a year ago or whenever, and killed it.
Killed it.
You guys went?
Yes. Yeah. At that point, after Atlanta, you come back to New York?
Yeah, but so in Atlanta is when I started doing the scratching, though. So one night, they were working on the song PE 2000, the Public Enemy song.
That was the first single.
First single, exactly. So they were working on that. They had been working on that in the Bahamas, and then in Atlanta, Puff recorded his vocals, and a bunch of people were writing for him
mm-hmm.
at the time. So, you know, someone would get half a verse, or people would work tag team on a verse or whatever. And I was a big Public Enemy fan, too. So one night after they all left the studio, Michael Patterson came into the room I was working in, and he's like, hey, you want to scratch on this song? I was like, sure. Meanwhile, I don't have, you know, they had turntable. Hey, none of the producers, at least in the Hitmen at the time, none of them were DJs. So, like, nobody scratched. Everybody used mixers and turntables just to sample. So you'd have a turntable plugged into a mixer, plugged into an MPC. And so we had that stuff, but we didn't have, like, I didn't have, like, my, you know, any of I didn't have my mixer or my battle records with scratch sounds on them. So I had to go through stacks of records, try to find a sound I could scratch that no one would recognize.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, I scratched on that song that night. And remember Mark Curry?
Yeah, of course.
So my real name is, my first name is Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, I had the name Fafu, but I think people were still calling me Mark back then. So Puff comes in the next day and hears the record, and he's like, who's scratching on this? And Michael Patterson's like, oh, that's Mark. And he's like, Mark Curry did this? And then, yeah, I saw Puff in the hallway that day. And he's like, I didn't know he was a DJ. And yeah, after that, he asked me to scratch on a bunch of records.
That's dope.
Yeah, it's dope. I still hear, like, there's a Shine song, That's Gangsta.
Yeah. Oh.
I have a solo at the end of that. Serious shit.
That's you?
That's me.
That's dope.
I still hear that on the radio, that's, like, in LA and shit.
That's a great song.
It is. Yeah. Dope.
A Waste of Time with It's the Real's 12 Days of Podcast are sponsored by the good people at Def Jam, who have taken over the holiday season with nothing but dope projects for everyone in your family. Got a cousin who just doesn't have his head on straight? Maybe he needs some inspiration. Maybe he's been sleeping through his life and needs that kick in the chest by amazing beats and powerful words? Well, give him the gift of Jeezy's new album, Pressure, which features 2 Chainz, Puff Daddy, Tory Lanez, Rick Ross, J. Cole, Kendrick Lamar, and more. Pressure is available on every streaming service, every download service, and of course, at JeezyShop.com, where you can get really cool merch bundles. Got a mother like ours who called the other day and wondered when the center of rap transitioned from New York City to Atlanta? Well, follow our lead and get mom a copy of that real New York City rap album by the legends Fabolous and Jadakiss called Friday on Elm Street. In fact, let mom hear that intro track produced by the great Ted Smooth and go from there. She will not be sorry. Got a coworker who you've been crushing on and you want to make a splash with during Secret Santa? Well, there's no better gift than Jhené Aiko's album Trip, which is available now on vinyl. Show love the Jhené way at the office and impress the Pam to your gym by playing Sativa and When We Were Young. And you know what? Take care of yourself this holiday season and pick up Jesse Boykins III's amazing album, Bartholomew, which has crazy features like No Name, Melanie Fiona, Dej Loaf, Bridget Kelly, Sid, Trinidad James, Audio Push, and more. Be the giving person you always wanted to be, you Grinches. This holiday season, stock those stockings with gifts from Def Jam Recordings. So Mark Curry was around then.
Yeah.
He had a very short-lived bad boy career.
Yeah.
Also, Shine was around then, too?
Yes. I think Shine first started coming around when we were in Atlanta. That was probably the first time I saw Shine. Yeah.
And he was writing?
Probably. He was working on... It was weird, because Shine had this huge buzz, and there was a bidding war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then I remember he was supposed to get on some remix for Wyclef. Wyclef came to the studio when we were in Atlanta. And I think, I forget the story, but Shine like had a tough time with the record or something, and he sent the one of the runners or something to the mall to, he's like, get the Chronic, get this Tupac album, get all these like classic hip hop albums, and he just sat there and listened to them over and over.
Wow.
And but yeah, I don't really remember Shine. I don't know if he was writing for Puff. He probably was.
He wrote for the Duets album. Or not the Duets. Was it Duets?
He wrote the song Notorious.
Yeah, that was on Born Again. Yeah. I worked on that album too. I have a couple great stories on that album.
So okay, so Atlanta wraps up. You head back up north.
Yep.
And Puff now knows you as DJ Fafu.
Yep.
And how do you move on from there?
So then they're like, all right, so move to New York. Right. I think at first they were putting me in a hotel, and they're like, dude, you gotta get a place. They're not gonna pay for a hotel. So I officially moved to New York. I subletted a place, and then I got a place in Chelsea. I was just at Daddy's house all the time.
And is Daddy's house now the way it was now, right?
It just closed.
Yeah. It just closed?
Ago. Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Like
2 years ago.
Yeah. Oh. And so you were there all the time. Who would come through?
Everybody. I mean, Busta would come through all the time. CeeLo would come through, actually in Atlanta and in New York. CeeLo was so cool, man. I ran into him in New York, and he's like, hey, he gives me like, how's it going? I'm like, I don't even remember meeting you the first time, but nice to see you. Just everybody, Nas, you know, everybody came through there.
Is that a weird thing, just being in a studio all, it's like being in a casino, no windows, you're just sort of like in this strange world, and then you come outside and it's all dark and...
Yeah, I mean, I'm a studio rat. I've been called that as a derogatory term too, but I mean, I like to spend time in the studio. That's fine with me.
And as far as studios go, Daddy's house was pretty top notch.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
great studio.
Forever comes out, and then how do things change in terms of like the production or the scratching or your involvement around that camp?
I was still really, really involved. Forever came out. Like, we were working on Forever, and we were working on the Mace album and the Kim album all at the same time, and the Seas album. Yeah. So after Forever came out, I'm pretty sure it was like Focus on Kim, Focus on This. And I remember when we were working on the Mace album, that was really like when he left.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the last things I did with Mace was they asked me to work with him on interludes for his album. And he came in and he had no energy. He was just like bummed. He was frowny face, not into it.
Frowny face Mace.
Frowny face Mace. That was going to be like an EP we were going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
So you had an idea.
I mean, I didn't know what the hell was going on, but then, yeah, all of a sudden he just bounced. I think it was, what did he do? He waited for his album to drop and then he was like, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah, there was a weird thing, like he was managed by Magic Johnson. He did a label deal with Jermaine Dupri, right?
Was that when he put out the Harlem World?
Yep. Mm-hmm. So did you know Loon at that time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Loon really more after the fact, because then he signed to Puff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was around Bad Boy for a while, but it was kind of on and off. I was never employed by them. It was just freelance work.
But you got your money.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Especially at first when they were still with Arista.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, once they started making the transitions to different labels, there would be little hiccups in the payments. And you'd have to hold things hostage to get paid. But I always got paid.
Yeah.
Shout out to Puff.
Yeah.
I know not everyone did.
So Puff obviously starts getting into some legal troubles. How does that affect you and the morale around the building?
Right. So you're talking about the Club New York thing?
Yeah.
Shine? Mm-hmm. I was there. I was at the studio. I think I was on a train coming back from Pennsylvania. Like, I went to visit family and I was on my way back to the studio. I was going to take the train right to, you know, Penn Station and walk up to Daddy's house. And I got the two-way page or whatever, like, don't come today. And yeah, and then I went to the studio the next day, and there was a back way you could get into Daddy's house without going in the front door. There was a way you could get out, and so somebody had opened that door, and I went in up through the stairwell, and I walked into Daddy's house when it was completely shut down, and they were like, yo, you need to get out of here and don't come back for like a week.
Wow, or whatever. Wow.
Yeah.
And then you looked on the tabloids the next day.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember all the things. I went to the trial, though. I went to one day because they were going to, PETA was going to come and protest Puff and like throw stuff at him because he wears furs or whatever.
Yeah.
So they wanted a bunch of people they knew to come and sit in the pews. So me and my girl went with a bunch of the people from Bad Boy one day, and it was fucking crazy. It was like Benjamin Bruffman and what's his name? Johnny Cochran. They were questioning his driver about the secret compartments in the Navigator. Yeah.
Lincoln.
And it was like, you got to turn the air conditioner up to full, turn this, and then push this button over here, and then the compartment would open.
So some real like James Bond shit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I remember there was a break in the middle of
the trial.
The day in court or whatever. Shine saw me. He's like, "Yo, Mark Pfefflin," whatever. And then I went up to Puff with my man Jimmy Lee, and Jimmy's like, "Yeah, it's getting really ill in there." And Puff's like, "Yeah, it's about to get iller." He was like he was fully into it. But yeah.
Well, did you think like that was it for you? Like,
nah, I knew Puff was gonna. It wasn't gonna be over. I mean, you got Johnny Cochran. He's got that much money, and I of course. I knew Puff, and people were saying that he shot people in the club. I knew there's no way that he would have shot someone
in
the club.
Right. Mm-hmm.
No way.
No, because you have to turn on the AC and then crank up this dial, and it's just too many steps.
Exactly.
So, but Shine goes away,
mm-hmm.
and then you're still with the Bad Boy camp?
Yeah.
So are you working with like G-Dep and Black Rob?
Yep. I worked on the big Born Again album,
mm-hmm.
big time. So they... A friend of mine produced a song on that record, and this guy Cornbread did a beat for one of the songs, and he couldn't figure out how to get Biggie's vocals to line up with his beat right. He had the right tempo, but it just wasn't working right. So I was like, oh, I got you. And I went in there and, you know, I just nudged the vocals around and just got it so it was perfect. And then, so he went back and played it for Harv and Comrade, and they were like, oh, Faf did this? All right, we want him to work on every song. Like,
whoa.
So I had to edit Big's vocals on every song to make sure they were riding the beat correctly.
You got all the acapellas.
Yeah, I mean, I just went into all the Pro Tools sessions
and
did it. And then This is a crazy story. So then one day they're like, hey, we need you to go to Hit Factory or, you know, one of the other studios and edit this other verse by one of the most famous rappers in the game, which I will not name. And I was like, what? But he rapped over this beat. And they're like, yeah, but you could probably make it better. So I edited someone's verse on that album that was not, it wasn't like a remix. They were actually rapping over this beat. And I'll tell you guys off air.
Yeah, and you made it sound better.
I don't know. I mean, who am I to say?
Right.
I was just like, this is ridiculous that I'm doing this.
How much instruction did they give you?
They weren't even there. They were like, go to, you know, Hit Factory Studios, whatever, and the engineer will have it up for you and just work on it. So I, you know, I copied the track so that they still had the original. And I did my edits, and I was like, I don't even know. I'm like, let me listen to any time he might be falling off beat a little bit and nudge it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can I guess, and if I'm right, we can bleep it out?
No.
Can I guess, and we'll bleep it out regardless?
As long as you definitely...
Yeah. Eminem?
No. All right, he guessed Eminem, and he was wrong. But I will tell you a crazy story about the Eminem verse on that. I'm glad you brought that up. Dead Wrong, probably my favorite song on that album.
Mm-hmm.
Chucky Thompson produced it, and Busta Rhymes was originally on it.
Mm.
And he had this, you know, the whole song is about just saying the most disgusting thing you could possibly say. So he had this crazy verse about like sticking his finger in a girl's butthole and all this shit. It was nuts. And then and they were like, Harv and whoever, I don't know, maybe it was Puff, heard it and they were like, nah, tell him to come back and do another verse.
Wow.
Which, I got to say, happened a lot. Busta Rhymes came back and redid his verses and did them way better the second time.
Wow.
More than once.
That's like his thing?
I don't know. I just noticed that happened a few times and stuff. Mm. And it's, I mean, you know, props to Bad Boy for, like, this is one of the illest MCs at the time, and they're like, no, that's not good enough, you got to do it better.
Mm. Wow.
And he did. And so Busta came back and did a second verse. They mixed the song, Puff did the ad libs to it, and then Harv is across town on in another studio with Eminem and records that Eminem verse and brings it back to the studio, and he brings it to me, and he's like, you got to put this Eminem verse in place of Busta. And all those ad-libs on that song is Puff actually ad-libbing Busta. So I had to edit Puff's ad-libs so it sounded like he's reacting to shit M said rather than what.
Wow.
Because at the beginning, he's like, ladies and gentlemen, or whatever. Right before M starts rhyming, he said like, ladies and gentlemen, Busta Rhymes or some shit. So I cut the Busta Rhymes out. And then I would just move his like, yeah, and over to so that it sounded like he was reacting. Yeah.
That's so dope.
Yeah. I also did the clean version of that song, which was the first time with Bad Boy where they would stop. That was one thing I did a lot over there, was be the clean edits, and I would put like sound effects in, which is always, I always thought that was kind of cheesy, but yeah. But then I'd hear like DMX songs on the radio, and instead of the curse words, it'd be like one of his one of his ad libs. So I was like, I'm gonna do that. So I took the acapella and took any of Biggie or Puffy's ad libs and just made like a, you know, chopped them up and made a, like a little folder of those, and then took out all the curses and then dropped in the ad libs. And one day Puff stopped me in the hallway at Daddy's house. He's like, yo, you did that Dead Wrong clean version? I was like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I just heard that on the radio, man. It sounded like it wasn't even an edit. I was like,
yes. When do you start doing Bless the Nation?
During that time. Yeah, it's Bless the Nation, not Bless the Nation.
Ah.
But yeah, I did that. So let's see. I met these guys, Ming and FS. They were like a jungle, like rave DJ duo.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing, like, they did a drum and bass remix of Benjamin's before, like, you know, the year before I got there. And I was making all these, a lot of the beats I was making were sort of fit. They were hip hop, but they kind of fit in that alternative, like not EDM, but they call it electronica, like down tempo, trip hop, whatever, you know, which is, I was really into that music too, like a lot of English stuff that was influenced by hip hop, but was
not.
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely rap over those beats, but they were trippier and psychedelic. And,
yeah. It was more destined for like raves and stuff.
Yes. 100%. But it would be like the rave room where you're coming down from your ecstasy and you want to chill, like whatever. So one of the guys at Bad Boy heard my beats and took it to Mingan FS, and they called me up. They're like, this stuff is amazing. We want to help you put out these, this music, but, you know, it's definitely underground. You won't make any money or whatever. But anyway, I got
to... Did you think that they were maybe looking for Mark Curry?
Maybe.
Yeah. Different Mark.
Yeah. So anyway, I hung out with Mingan FS a little bit. They lived right near Daddy's house. And while I was over there one time, I met Wordplay from Bless the Nation. And they already were Bless the Nation, Various and Wordplay. And they had a production deal with Mingan FS. So Ming calls me up one day and he's like, you should get up with Bless the Nation and make some, you know, play them some of your beats. Do some stuff with them. If it's good enough, we'll put it on their album or whatever. So these dudes were signed to Mingan FS, and I think they felt like they weren't being given the attention that they wanted, and, you know, they weren't working fast enough. Nothing was really happening for them. So they came over to my studio. I started renting a little studio, which was on 26th Street, right next door to Baseline. And they came over to my studio, which was like, we called it the hot box. It was, I could literally touch both walls like this. And it was this narrow room with high ceilings, but it was this narrow, it was longer than this, but, yeah, and so they came over and listened to some of my beats, and they were like, I probably played them 10 beats the first time, and they're like, we like every single one of these beats. Wow. And I think it was just like the perfect combination. Like, they were kind of, like, my stuff was definitely a little bit too underground for Bad Boy, but these dudes were definitely in on some irreverent, like, white boy, you know, they were young, they were, it was kind of like, it kind of sounded like, you know, the topic wise, like Odd Future's early stuff, like Tyler and Earl, you're like,
dark.
That's the kind of stuff they were rapping about, yeah. And stuff. So, and that fit perfectly with my production and I think my sound at the time, which was influenced by drum and bass and hip hop, even though it was hip hop beats, but I would distort the bass and distort the drums and do all these like interesting things. So there, we kind of had our own sound at first, which was a kind of an underground indie hip hop sound, and these guys were very lyrical. They were influenced by, you know, all the Backpackers and the M&Ms and the, you know, people like that. So it just kind of worked. And then so we did some songs, and the second or third song that we did, actually Wordplay calls me up. He left this crazy message for me where he's like, I got a record, I need you to flip. If you don't do it, I'm going to take it to one of your Bad Boy dudes. And it was Bananarama Cruel Summer.
What?
He shows up in my studio with this Bananarama album, which he borrowed from some DJ. And I'm like, what is this? Like,
we're gonna... On vinyl.
Yeah, on vinyl. So I go to sample it, and I slow the record way down because I'm like, oh, I'm going to flip this and make it into some grimy thing or whatever. He's like, no. Keep it the original tempo. I want it to be the original, like the original song. I want to rap over the song. So we we kept the lyrics in for the verse. So I made a beat where I used the chorus from the song as the chorus. There's a verse of like a first verse is just a regular 16 bar rap verse. Then there's the chorus, and then the second verse is like the lyrics to the song, hot summer days, whatever. And then he raps in between the lines, like he's answering the girl. And the whole song is about like how, like, it. We changed it because we tried to clear the sample and they said we couldn't call it Cruel Summer. So we used a line from his verse, one of his verses, that was summer sucks without drugs, sluts, and cheese. So we were going to call the song Summer Sucks, but then in parentheses.
Yes.
Tag. And it was all about how you had, they would like give girls ecstasy to sleep with them and shit like that. Wow. Like, it was a grimy song. Yeah, grimy lyrics, but it sounded like a Will Smith, Puff Daddy, right. like bouncy.
Right. Hype Williams.
Like, yes.
Yeah,
100%. Yeah, yeah. So that was like the second or third song I did with them. All the other songs were grimy.
Also, Bananarama was very willing to get paid for that, but they didn't want to call it Cruel Summer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they owned it.
Oh, okay, got it.
They probably didn't write it, and they probably didn't own the master for sure.
Actually, they didn't even sing it.
Oh, really?
That's possible. Really?
Cruel Summer was done by, like, it's sort
it was
of
like a Milli Vanilli?
Milli Vanilli situation.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Had no idea.
That's so weird, because I actually worked with one of the singers from Bananarama. I guess that was before this all happened, though.
Let me make sure I'm saying this. I'm just, like, slandering.
but they didn't get involved yet, like, Bananarama, it eventually had to get cleared much later, but at first it was just like this thing that everybody that heard it was like, oh my God, this is going to be huge.
Yeah.
So I just delved full time into, I mean, I still worked at Bad Boy, but in all my other time, I had my own studio. I was making beats and I was working with Blessed Nation. And then eventually I couldn't sign them to a production deal because they already were in one. So we waited for that time to lapse. And then I joined the group.
And did Bad Boy know this other side of you?
Yeah. I mean, at one point, I was in the studio with Puff, and this is very early in the Blessed Nation time, and it was just me and Puff working on something. We used to do the music beds for the Sean John fashion shows.
Wow.
Which was amazing. That's a whole other story, because Puff would basically, he wanted to be called DJ Fusion, and I would be sitting there, he'd have a CD player, they'd go down to Tower Records or whatever it was, the big record store in Times Square, and just come back with like bags and bags of CDs, and he would just play random things, like not beat matching or anything, just overlapping weird, like different styles of music, and like just random happy accidents. Like he'd play the Doors, you know, and then we'd go into Method Man, like Release Your Duff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was dope. Like, that was fun. But anyway, we were in there, just me and him working one day, and I was like, oh, and this is, you know, Eminem had become really hot in that year. So everyone was like signing their white rappers or whatever.
Right.
So I said to Puff, I was like, yo, you got to hear these white boys I'm fucking with. And he's like, all right, put it on. So I played this song called Not To Be Stopped, and his phone rang right as it starts playing, and I'm like, ah, he's not even going to pay attention. The verse kicks in, wordplay goes first. His verse kicks in, and he's holding the phone up to his ear, and he drops it down. And he's like, they white? and I was like, yeah. And he's like, tell them to come in. So I had them come to the studio that day.
Wow.
And this is also during the trial, with the Shine thing or whatever. So they came to the studio not looking like rappers particularly, from what I remember.
What were they wearing?
Just like kind of normal stuff. Like, you know, I feel like it's interesting. I feel like when you take those meetings, you need to like present yourself, how you need to let them see what the people are going to see.
Right.
I don't think there was any, it was so like, let's just do this. Like, yo, come to this. I'm at daddy's house. Come to the studio, 44th Street or whatever.
And Puff didn't see it.
No, he did. We played him. The thing is, we didn't play him Cruel Summer, which was my decision. And I was worried that it was going to get stolen or something.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was a good decision or not. But he called me that day. The next day, he called me and he was like, yo, I like those white boys. Let me just finish this trial. Let me get through this, and then we'll do something. And he was like, but I don't want any production company involved. I don't want this. I don't want that. Like, he was really talking about it. And even, what was her name? Fran Spiro. She told me, rest in peace. She told me that they were like talking about like budgets and all that kind of stuff. So he was into it. And then, I think the trial dragged on for a long time. We kept making music. We made hundreds and hundreds of songs in those first couple of years. It would be like, I'd be at the studio like, yeah, we got 120 songs. You know what I mean? Like,
and you guys eventually did sign.
Yeah. We went through a bunch of different things. We put out an indie, just a self-released indie CD before that. And I remember Puff listening to that. And we were going to sign with this indie label called Recon. And they put us on the Lyricist Lounge tour in a bus with Killa Priest. Shout out to him. And that tour was with Scarface and Eric Sermon.
Wow.
And Graf and somebody else. And so we were like popping a little bit. So the Cruel Summer song, also, Ron, you know Ron Gilliard, you know who that is?
Mm-mm.
He was like an executive at Bad Boy, and he had left, and he went to J Records, which Clive had just started. So he calls me up and wanted me to do a clean edit of an Olivia song. She was signed to Jay before G-Unit.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. She had a song called I'm About to Biz Ounce. So.
Oh, I know that song. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm About to Biz
Ounce. Yeah, yeah. So he asked me to do a clean edit to that, and I worked on it. And then around that time, we made this Cruel Summer song, and I was like, wow, this is. I mean, it was like one of those songs when you heard it, you're like, yeah, this has all the elements of what you need to have a radio song or whatever. So. I hit up Ron and I was like, I got a hit song. I got to play it for you. And I think when I went in there, he was like, are you trying to pitch a song for an artist? Or like, I was like, no, I have an artist with a song. It's crazy. And so I played him the song. He was like, okay, I want you to meet with our hip hop A&R. So he linked me up with Trevor Gerardo. Shout out to him. And Trevor, they had just started J Records. They didn't have an office yet. They were in the Waldorf Astoria, like Jesus. In rooms where the offices were. So we met with Trevor. We would go into Trevor's office and play him like three or four songs. And he was like, wow, this stuff is incredible. He's like, look at that stack of CDs and tapes in the corner. That's all the demos I've gotten since we started. He's like, this is better than everything in that stack.
Wow.
And you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but he said it, and he kept having us come back, and we just keep every time we'd have like three or four new songs, we'd go up there and play them for him, and he started coming to shows. I don't know if like whatever it was like that with a lot of different people though. You know, you just keep meeting and hope that it progresses into something. Then also Kenny Burns, I don't know if you guys know
yep.
who that is.
Yep.
He managed a group called The Dream or Dream.
Dream, yeah.
Dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They were the girl
group. They were the girl group that was signed to Bad Boy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So he was their manager.
And he was later an A&R for Rockefeller.
He was that before.
Oh, he's before. Okay.
He was right. He was a Rockefeller A&R, I think, for like Reasonable Doubt or something.
No,
like,
not that early.
It's he had plaques on his wall that were like
photoshopped.
Well, it said Kenny Burns, and it was like it was early Jay shit. I don't think it was Reasonable Doubt, but it was like some early shit. Mm-hmm. It was before all this. I met Kenny at Daddy's house. He had me put a show tape together for Dream or something, and I played him Cruel Summer, and he flew us. Oh my god, this is a great story too. He flew us to LA to meet with Andre Harrell. Now Andre Harrell, who I knew from Bad Boy because he was president of Bad Boy when I was there for some stretch of it. He had been hired to run Babyface's label, New America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Babyface had this new label in L.A. So Kenny was like, I want to manage y'all. I'm going to get you signed. Like, he was hype. Like, that dude is just hype anyway. And he was really, really into it. And he was calling us all the time. And you know, he was just very involved. And so he was like, I'm gonna bring you guys out here to L.A., and get you signed with this label. And he was A&R at New America at the time. So he flew us to LA, put us in some fancy hotel, and he shows up the day of the, yeah, I guess it was all in one day. So he comes to the hotel and he has like a quarter ounce of weed and just throws it down on the table. And he's like, roll up or whatever. And now I already know, maybe I didn't, but I already know that, like, getting high before going into a meeting
is a great idea.
Great idea.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the dudes, the MCs, they were all about it.
Well,
so
how good was the weed?
It was L.A. It was good-ass weed.
Were there orange hairs in it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't remember, but it was good weed. So, we rolled two joints or something, and we go. He drives us over to the office. I want to remember this story right. We walk into the Andre Harrell's office. I found out later they had just gotten the first edit back on the new Babyface video, and Babyface was really unhappy with how he looked in the video, and all of his stress was being filtered down onto Kenny.
Oh my god.
Or I mean onto Andre.
Yeah.
So Andre was really like under pressure at this moment. So we go into his office. He recognizes me because he's seen me in the studio with Puff, but he doesn't really know me. And he's like, Kenny says, give one joint to Andre and just light the other one. And so Wordplay or Various, one of the two, tries to hand the joint to Andre. And Andre goes, I'm working. This is professional, like some shit like that. Like, nah, I'm working right now or something. So he takes the joint but doesn't light it. And meanwhile, or no, maybe Kenny tried to give it to him, and he said some shit like that, and I caught it, but the dudes, the Various and Wordplay, didn't notice, and they lit the joint in the office. In front, it was just so weird. And Andre was like it was one of those meetings where, like, some people are really open when you're trying to present them with music, mm-hmm. and like want to make you feel comfortable and like, yeah, play me what you got. Let's see what it is. This wasn't one of those meetings. This was like
Andre was not showing whether or not he was like into it.
He was basically, before he even heard anything, he made it sound like he wasn't into it. Like,
cool.
Yeah, it was like one of those, like, you ever heard the story of Beanie Siegel rapping for Jay-Z, and Jay doesn't crack a smile, doesn't nod his head or whatever, and Beanie's like, I'm definitely, this isn't working out, and he's on his way back to Philly, and they're like, you're signed.
Yeah.
That's like Lorne Michaels.
Okay, yeah, like that kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. So, and I think, you know, that's just a thing. That's just how it is sometimes. So
that's how we are in this apartment. You come over here, we're not going to budge an inch.
Why are you ice grilling me right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, just intimidate you. That's why we don't have the cameras on.
So it didn't go well. And then Andre's like, you guys are rappers, rap for me. Meanwhile, these dudes are high, paranoid probably at this point, because we're getting the prickly vibes. Yeah. And Wordplay's like, yeah, I don't want to rap. And he's like, I thought y'all were rappers. You don't want to rap? Like, I never heard of a rapper didn't want to rap or whatever. And we're like, well, we don't have the instrument. He's like, just rap. And then they were like, nah. So I think they ended up like rapping over the lyrics or something on one of the songs. It did not go well. And I don't remember all the specifics, but I remember we had to leave and then come, like, we had to move to another room, and then he came over. But yeah, we basically lit a joint in Andre Harrell's office, and he was like, not happy.
So it didn't happen for New America.
Didn't happen for New America, but then the next, that was like, I remember coming out of that meeting, like, feeling like completely defeated.
Yeah.
Went back to the hotel. The next morning, we went to Capitol Records, and we met with that guy. The guy who Ice Cube comes in and smashes all the things on the wall
yeah.
in that scene. I can't remember his name. But he was really into it. And so then all of a sudden, like, we were like, fuck New America. We're going to sign to Capitol Records. And they had, like, you know, Chronic on the wall and shit like that. So, I mean, that was the end of that trip. But we tried to work that angle. And then at some point, Kenny was telling us that the Capitol was going to do the deal. And then Noah Callahan Bever, shout out to Noah, who was a huge supporter of ours.
And he's at Mass Appeal at this point.
No, this is after Mass Appeal. I want to say he's at Vibe mm-hmm. at that yep. point. He was going to write a big article about us for Vibe. He had already put us in a bunch of articles in Mass Appeal, some small stuff in Vibe. And like, he was always getting us all this press. It was awesome. Shout out to that guy. But he was writing an article about us for Vibe, and this was going to be like this big introduction to us. So his bosses or whatever, they were like, well, yeah, you got to call Capitol and make sure they're really going to do this deal. So they called Capitol and they were like, yeah, we're going to sign them. And he told me this, and then they called him back the next day. They're like, actually, we're not.
Oh.
Yeah. So I found out from him that Capitol wasn't going to sign us.
That's crazy.
Yeah. That's what that's the music business, though. There were so many.
You're always finding out stuff from the press, yeah.
Well, or you're just like almost this, almost yeah. that. Like, so many things. Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Like when we did the. And then I guess before. This is all completely out of order, but before that, we had the Cruel Summer remix had ended up in. Got landed in the movie Blue Crush. And then And that was on Universal Pictures, but the soundtrack came out on Virgin. And I don't remember who was running Virgin at the time, but they were going to sign us to Virgin. And I mean, the thing about that song was anybody that wanted to sign us based on that song was like, what's the follow up? And we never could do like another pop song like that. Like every time we tried, it was like a fail. So that was kind of a blessing and a curse anyway. But we had heard that Virgin was going to sign us, and that was going to be the single, and they were going to run with it. But then, the girl that sang the background vocals on the song sued us because she was dating some like lawyer guy who I knew from Bad Boy and didn't like or whatever. But, and I don't think anybody likes this guy, but But he was like, oh, you can make, get some money out of this. So he tried to get it so that it was Blestination featuring her. And all she did was sang over the sample.
Right.
Like the vocals from Bananarama or whoever Milli Vanilli it was were in the record, and she was just blended in with them, and she did some ad libs, and the ad libs ended up in the commercial, and that's how they found out about it. And so he was like, I guess he didn't really sue us, but he tried to like
intimidate you.
Yeah. And tried
with a baseball bat.
No, I almost showed up with a baseball bat. Basically the day that they had the blue carpet for Blue Crush in LA, he sent out not a cease and desist, but he put an injunction on the film based on the fact that this wasn't sorted out yet. So it made us look terrible, and any deal that we had based on that was off the table.
Holy
but
shit.
It was already too late to take this. The song was already mixed into the movie, and the soundtrack was already made, like, or pressed or whatever. So
did you like watching the movie when you were there, though?
I didn't go to the blue carpet event, but I watched it in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
It was weird watching it. It was like a little unsettling.
Because the plot was not...
No, it's a good movie, but I felt like uncomfortable hearing my music in the film for some reason.
It was the first time. But let's talk about, you know, the actual plot of the movie. What is it? Is like, I don't want to talk about this.
Who cares?
Was that the shark movie?
No, that's a different thing. Jaws. No.
It's girl surfers, though.
Yeah, it's girl surfers, and then like one of them is hot.
Okay.
One of them is hotter than the others.
And the other is Michelle Rodriguez.
Yeah.
So the group doesn't last. Ultimately.
Well, we got signed after that.
You did get signed.
Yeah, we eventually got signed to Geffen.
Right. And Mr. Morgan was your manager.
Mr. Morgan and Paul Rosenberg, co-managers.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Mr. Morgan, who is now running OVO.
Shout out to Mr. Morgan.
Paul Rosenberg, who is now running Def Jam.
Shout out to Paul.
And Noah Callahan-Bever, who is now running marketing at Def Jam.
Shout out to Noah.
Crazy how things work.
And Steven Victor was our publicist.
Crazy.
You had all the top layers of Def Jam.
Yes.
You guys were about 10 years too early.
I think so.
Yeah.
So you signed to Geffen.
Yeah. Paul took us to Geffen. We signed to Geffen right before Geffen kind of folded.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you guys ultimately don't last.
Yeah. Well, what happened was we spent 2 years making that record. Or we, not even, it was like, it took a year to clear the samples on the record.
Yeah.
But it took 2 years before, once we got signed and once we mixed and mastered the record. The week that we mastered the album, they fired 75 employees from Geffen, including our A&R guy, our product manager, everybody working on our project.
Not great.
Not great. Yeah. So we had this record, and there was still like, they hadn't even released a single yet. And, yeah, we just eventually got dropped as they were kind of cleaning house, and anything that wasn't already making them money, they didn't want to lose any more money on. So,
who was making money for Geffen?
Guns N' Roses, maybe?
Yeah, Nirvana. Yeah.
Splash
and the gang.
So, after that project comes to an end for you, are you still focused on the music business?
Yeah, I was working on a bunch of things while I was working on that album. I was producing this guy. Me and Harry Fraud did an album with a guy named MCEO, who's super dope and still has never really like put anything out. Super talented guy. And then I was working with this singer-songwriter named Lonnie from Jersey, from like the Jersey Shore somewhere. Who is an incredible singer-songwriter, kind of influenced by Nirvana, but also hip hop. Like, we made a whole record. So I was going to try to get them deals based off of our incredible classic album that we were going to drop, hopefully. And, yeah. And so I was doing those things. Also, while we were signed to Geffen, Paul Rosenberg brought us, video cameras. He was like, you guys are kind of crazy. You should just film everything. And this is like mini DV, you know, like the little camcorders. So
yeah.
we were filming and filming just everything or whatever. And then, oh, that's right. And then our A&R guy, Mike Chavez, shout out to him. We had a mixtape that we were going to drop right before that, like to set up the album.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, man, everybody does mixtapes. You guys should make a DVD.
Which nobody was doing.
Everybody still makes mixtapes. Nobody makes DVDs now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know if they were or not. But anyway, so we already had this mixtape, and it was like a lot of songs. And I was like, you want me to make a video? You want us to make videos for every single song? He's like, yeah. So, which we probably could have got away with just doing like half of them or whatever. But we were ambitious. So we ended up shooting our own like super crappy videos to all these mixtape records. And we'd have people like, shout out to Clay Patrick McBride. He shot a couple things for us, and a couple other friends. One of the guys in the Various had a friend named Dylan who was a graffiti artist and just an artist in general. And he was basically directing and editing the whole DVD. And he came over to our studio one time and gave me Final Cut Pro. Wow. And I was like, I don't do that. I make music. But then one day we had a song with R.A. the Rugged Man on the mixtape. And in iMovie, I cut together a bunch of scenes from like a Peanuts movie to that song. And it was really fun. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is fun. I want to edit. And it was funny because I made like Charlie Brown was one of them. I can't remember who the other one was. And then when R.A. came on, I had Pigpen.
Yeah.
Shout out to Ari.
So you weren't worried about any more cease and desist coming your way?
No, quite the contrary.
Yeah, you just Charles sort of like, yeah, leaned into it.
Yeah, no, totally. So,
well,
so
Charles Schultz was dead at that point, so like, you were good.
Yeah. I mean, what's he going to do?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I learned to edit video in that process there.
You didn't even need to go to school for that.
Never. Yeah. And, yeah.
So now you have this skill set that goes beyond music, and how does that whole thing lead you to translation and Steve Stout?
So Morgan was still managing when Morgan was managing us, he would have me do like they used to call them viral videos when it was like, oh, this isn't an actual video, we're gonna make a viral video.
Yeah, anything less than like, you know, $30,000 is a viral video.
Yeah, I think he was giving me like $500 and like the first one he had me do the Kid Daytona, and Jim Jones had a song, and it was, I can't remember the name of the song, but they gave me a bunch of like knockout videos of like, you know, boxing videos. And I had to just make a video. It was like a montage of boxing scenes and stuff. And then he brought me this Cardinal and Akon song called Graveyard Shift. And Akon is rapping on the song. I don't know if you guys ever heard it.
No.
But it's a dope song. And he's like, make a video for this. And I was like, he's like, come up with an idea. So it was like Graveyard Shift, and I was talking to Harry Fraud that day, and I was like, man, what should I do? And he's like, you should just get the first season of The Wire and use all of the nighttime scenes from that. So Morgan borrowed Cypher Sound's box set of the season one of The Wire, and I ripped all that footage, and we put together this video that was all scenes from The Wire to this song. And so they sent it to Cardi, loved it. They sent it to Akon. He's like, there's only one thing wrong with this video. I'm not in it. So he flew Cardi down to Atlanta for like an hour. And he was like going from Africa to somewhere. And he was going to be in. So they met in Atlanta, picked him up, drove into the hood somewhere. They used for lights, they used the headlights, I think, of his SUV. Mm-hmm. Just pulled up. Two takes, two different spots. They sat there, ran through the whole song, and sent me the footage. I basically had two complete passes of the song with those two, and I interspersed it into the video with the Wire stuff.
That's incredible.
And that video did go super viral. It was awesome. Dope video. But then YouTube took it down because there was like a shot of there was a scene of Omar holding a shotgun up to a little kid's face or something.
Also, a ton of Wire footage that they didn't
right,
own.
That you stole.
You can still do that though now.
I guess.
But it was like it had to do with the guns, I think.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then a bunch of videos like that, and then me and Clay started making videos for like for the Blessed Nation album. We made one video together that Clay directed and I edited, and it was like really official.
By the way, people should know out there that Clay is an amazing photographer and did my favorite photo of all time, which is the Jay-Z and Kanye as JFK and RFK shot from Double XL magazine, like when, like 2005 or so, when Jay-Z was president of Def Jam.
Yeah. Shout out to Clay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were making videos, and I was just kind of like, oh, cool, I can make music videos too. And so I kind of got into that. Then I ended up making a video with French Montana for New York Minute with Jadakiss,
mm-hmm.
which I actually mixed as well. And I think I was already a translation at that point, though. And yeah, I did a couple videos for Saigon.
And this is all through Harry Fraud, or
no? The French was
right. That's what I'm saying.
Saigon signed to this label called Suburban Noise, which put out the Blessed Nation album as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they had seen the videos Clay and I had done, and they were like, "Can you make one for Saigon or whatever?" So I ended up making two for Saigon, and I was just making videos, and then a friend of mine, Nert, shout out to Nert. He was like a big, I mean, he was friends with one of the guys in Blesty. He used to come to all of our shows and stuff. And so he knew me to some extent for reasons I can't say on the air, but he called me one time and was like, "Hey, this girl I know is a copywriter at Translation." And I think he mentioned Steve Stout and Jay-Z or something, but it just went like, I didn't even register
you didn't
that.
Care. Yeah.
I didn't register it, but he was like, they're looking for a video editor. So I'm like sending all these videos I had done, and one of them, the one that really got them psyched was the Akon and Cardi video, because it was ripped footage from The Wire, maybe, and that's what we do a lot of that in advertising, and and it was very rhythmic, like my cuts were very rhythmic, and they just liked it or whatever. And they told me, they were like, "That's that Akon thing is what sealed the deal." So I came in and just did like a freelance project for them for Wrigley Gum, and it was like a long process, and I was like, "Wow, this is cool. I'm making way more money." and then they kept calling me in, and eventually there was like, just stay here.
What was the most like weirdest corporate thing that you had to get used to?
Translation's not that corporate, at least not where I am.
I remember first visiting you, and they let you do whatever you wanted on the separate floor, way in the corner.
Yeah.
As long as you light 7 sticks of incense, then you're good.
But you've been there for how many years now?
8 years.
8 years. And what are some of the more prouder things that you've done over there?
Well, we launched Made in America Festival.
That's big.
That was big. I made a video for that, like a teaser video that Jay put on his Life and Times website.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a 15-minute teaser, which was basically black and white stock footage of crowds and then like some landmarks from Philadelphia. And then at the end, it said, "Made in America," nothing else. And when we sent it over to Jay, he was like, "Oh, change this, put this music in there." He sent me the Ham instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the music in there. And then, he was like, you know, because I think the Made in America came up in red at first because it was Budweiser.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, "Nah, make it white," mm-hmm. and whatever. He kind of art directed a little bit. And then that came out, and everyone was like talking about it. Like, what is this? Is this a movie? Is it a concert? Is it a tour? Is it an album?
Mm-hmm.
But why would it be an album if it has a song, the music from Watch the Throne in there? You know, so And then I ended up working on a lot of stuff around Made in America. I also, the other thing I was really proud of, I did a documentary of Rihanna over there. They had, it was also through Budweiser. They did some spots with her, and they commissioned some guy to do like a 10-minute mini documentary about her tour in Europe, or about her fans, and he interviewed her fans and stuff. And then the director did an edit and sent it over, and everyone was like, "What the fuck is this?" And so they gave me the hard drives of all the footage, and they're like, "Don't tell anybody you're working on this. Don't come into the office. Just go home, work on this for like a week, and just make whatever you can out of it." And luckily, this guy never got an interview with Rihanna when he was on the tour, and he also didn't have any complete songs, performances. So, I had all that stuff because we were doing a campaign with her. So, we had a crew interview her at one of the shoots, And luckily, she talked about her fans, and this whole thing was about her fans. And then we also had a performance for some reason. There was some video I had to make where they sent me a performance from the tour of the song Diamonds. So I made the whole concert or the whole documentary end with her performing Diamonds, and the kids, some of the fans this guy had interviewed, were in the front row singing along with Diamonds, crying. It was amazing.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts.
It's very easy that it could have been like somebody was talking to Rihanna about like chicken noodle soup, and it's like, well, how do I fit this in?
Right. No, it all worked out really well. And I ended up, so I also, for that documentary, we put a bunch of Rihanna songs in, like instrumentals as the music bed, and some film scoring type stuff. And then they were like, we can't afford Rihanna songs for this. So I think Rihanna gave us a couple songs. Like, we had to have Diamonds, and we had to have some other ones. And then there was a new song they wanted to push. But all the other songs, they're like, we got to replace that. So I ended up doing all the original music in the film.
Holy shit.
I color corrected the film. I mixed the song Diamonds because I got the multi-track of the live performance from that particular show the morning that Rihanna had to see the video and approve it before she was going to like Asia for on tour or something. So I got the stuff FedExed to my house, mixed it at home, went into the studio, finished the mix, and they like sent it out. Yeah. Somebody took it to somewhere and played it for her. And she was like, she loved it, and her mom saw it and cried.
That's amazing.
So you really like Akon'd it.
I know.
I totally Akon'd it.
I hope it's not lost on you that you're like the wolf. You're like, you know,
yeah, the,
like
from the Pulp Fiction. Who, yeah.
You just fix things.
I'm a fixer.
Yeah. Like you fixed the unnamed rapper on the Biggie album. You fixed the
dead wrong ad libs.
Yep, the ad libs. You fixed the Rihanna video when you weren't supposed to tell anybody.
That's true, though. People rarely come to me to do the thing, but when shit goes wrong, they're like, Faf can fix this.
Listen, I'm just mad that you didn't fix that Babyface video. Then you could have gotten like a label deal, and you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. Actually, that's before my video days.
I know.
You also should have fixed Andre Harrell's face when he got offered that weed.
Shout out to Andre Harrell.
Oh, my God.
The guys in Blessed Nation made up names for everybody. Like just...
For like George Bush when he's like, oh, like, you're wearing glasses, you're glassy. You're beardy.
It would be more like a play on words based on their name, and it would always be a put down. So they called Andre Harrell On Way to Hell.
Maybe that's why you guys didn't get the deal.
Yeah, I don't think they should have said that right to his face.
Yo, Faf, thank you so much for coming through. Congratulations on everything, and we'll see you very soon.
Sounds good.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this new episode of A Waste Time with It's The Real. Jeff, if people want to find out more about us, we're It's The Real. If people want to find out more about this podcast, it's called A Waste of Time with It's The Real, and we have done over 150 episodes. If people want to find out where they can go get their tickets for our big show on January 10th, 2018 at SOBs, our live podcast from that stage, Jeff, where can they go?
You can always go to itsthereal.com. Go buy your tickets today. They are there waiting for you. And I say tickets with an S because, you know, buy a couple. Because
it'd be super.
Yeah. If you want to listen to any of our old episodes or even our upcoming episodes, you can go to soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. We are also on iTunes. Search for A Waste of Time with It's The Real. We are on Twitter at It's The Real, Facebook at It's The Real, Instagram at It's The Real, Snapchat we are It's The Real, and on Twitch we are It's The Real because It's The Real was taken.
But we haven't even used Twitch yet. That's my biggest problem with that. We just are holding this down in case anybody is looking to take our name, right?
We are on Twitch because if you guys want us to play video games, we're not going to, but we can live stream.
That's what we're going to do?
What? We're going to be on there and talk about how we don't want to play video games.
Do you want to do that live at SOBs on January 10th?
Not play videos? Oh, yeah, no.
Play video games.
We should play video games. That's a good idea.
All right. So,
guys, video games with Jay-Z and us.
Maybe. You know that this podcast isn't going anywhere unless you start spreading the word. And hey, spread the word. Tell people about A Waste of Time with It's The Real. The content is too good for it just to be your little secret. So, tell all your friends, family, and fans out there. We know it starts with us. Jeff, who would you like to shout?
I want to shout out
Dan of Steel 007 out in the UK, who just watched our interview with DJ Semtex and said this is possibly one of the most insightful interviews people should see.
Hey, go to youtube.com/itsthereal and watch that video. Watch the Rockefeller video. Watch all of our videos. youtube.com/itsthereal. Jeff, I want to shout out a bunch of friends that I saw last night at the Brownies party at the Ace Hotel, which is one of our favorite parties that we like to go to every month. Shout out to Ayana and Brianna. Shout out to Loki and Della and Cam and everybody that we were hanging with. Dwayne, a whole bunch of people that we were hanging out with. Oh my God, a ton of people out there who we love congregating with, partying on the dance floor. Chris Styles, just a whole lot of good people. And especially Scotty Beam, who was hosting it. Deani is the best, and she always looks out for your boys. It's the real. Not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys tomorrow.
Can you believe it? This episode of the 12 Days of Podcast has been sponsored by the good people of Def Jam, who have dropped Jeezy's Pressure on Spotify, Google Play, Amazon, and on JeezyShop.com. Go visit JeezyShop.com today to listen to This Is It, track 5, my favorite track on the album, aside from, obviously, American Dream with J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar, which everybody loves because J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar are on it, but also because it's a great song. Anyway, tomorrow's episode is day 6 of the 12 Days of Podcast. We are coming back with OT Genesis.